welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast. My name is Jessica. I am one of your hosts. I am here with...
Jen, I'm a library aide here at Syosset.
And last but not least, our goddess in pink is...
Stacey Mencher? I'm sorry, you caught me. I was like, what?
No joke. We are here recording as of this day on April 1st with somebody super, super amazing who we are so excited to be here. We cannot believe that this person is actually here with us. Could you please introduce yourself?
Are you talking about me?
Yeah.
I was getting hyped up. I was like, there's going to be a guest on this that I'm excited about. I have no idea. That's amazing.
There might be a cat, as we warned before, right, that walks across the screen.
You're extremely kind to introduce me so generously. My name is Will Wheaton. I'm an actor, an author, a husband, and a dad.
Awesome. And before we get going, and actually this is relevant to the book, Still Just a Geek, that is coming out on April 12th, which will be the day that this episode drops.
Oh, cool.
Happy 20th anniversary to your big internet joke.
Wow, I had totally forgotten about that. This is, oh, man. Yeah, 20 plus years ago on April Fool's Day, I wrote a blog post in the early days of like internet 2.0, or maybe it was even 1.0 back then. Maybe it was like 1.5 then. I guess 2.0 would probably be like the dig era. But anyway, whatever, however we want to define it, I wrote a post in which I declared that I had been cast to be a Wesley Crusher on, I think it was Star Trek Enterprise. And I wrote it fully expecting the internet to go, shut up, Wesley, we hate you, blah, 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 yeah. And instead, the internet was like, this is amazing, we're so excited for you. And I felt like such a dick. I felt so bad that like I couldn't even leave it up all day long. I immediately had to take it down. I got to tell you, and I write about it in the book, I did not expect that reaction. It was astonishing. And also like it felt so good and so validating. It was one of those, oh my gosh, maybe they don't hate me moments. Yeah, and now I'm working on the ready room for Star Trek. So in a way, like I did actually get to come back. It took a while, but I got to come back.
Well, that was a really good impression of the internet back then.
I was going to say, really spot on impression of the trolls.
So, yeah, we have a lot of stuff we want to chat about. So let's
geek out on.
Yeah, awesome. Let's jump right into it.
Let's do it.
I loved so many things about this book. And one of the things that I loved in particular was the structure and how you use the footnotes to comment on your past writing. And I thought it was such an interesting way to structure something so that you were in conversation with all of these past selves, you know? And I'm wondering, like, what was that like? How did you land on that structure? And like, how did it develop?
I am thrilled to hear you describe it as a conversation with past selves, because that was my intention. That is what I hoped readers would get out of this work. And so far, as I talk to people about it, I'm hearing pretty consistently descriptions of what I hoped people would get out of it, which makes me feel like whether, you know, a wider audience ends up liking it or not, whether it sells a lot or not, whether it is reviewed well or not, what I am hearing is that the thing I hoped to communicate, the experience I hoped to create, is the one that people are having, and that delights me. So thank you for that. I am not able or willing to accept full credit for that. I share it with my editor, David Pomerico. David went through the book before I even looked at it. And just highlighted passage after passage after passage and said, these are things that I have questions about. I suspect you will too. What do you think? And he and I just kind of like started having a conversation in notes as I went through it. I would write things and ask him questions, and then he would respond and ask me questions. And with his help and guidance, I was able to figure out what part of me I needed to talk to and how I wanted to communicate to that part of me. I started out as someone who's almost 50, feeling impatient with the person I was when I was almost 30. I found myself just being kind of like embarrassed and I don't want to say shame, because I think shame is a very powerful word, and shame is something abusers use. So I work very hard to live a life free of shame. But in the way we would say, I was kind of ashamed of myself, like it's kind of like that. And I had to find a way to have compassion and empathy for the person I was when I wrote Just a Geek. And that was cathartic and healing in ways that I absolutely did not expect, because it forced me as a human being to find that compassion and empathy for myself.
I think that it's so amazing that you say it like that, because, you know, I'm just a geek and a librarian, but you know, I mean, we're all growing, and we're all trying to sort of like, sometimes we look back on ourselves and we're just like, oh my God, what was that about? But I think that it's important to realize that you can have these conversations with your past self and be like, listen,
I look at the world around me, and I see a world where we have grown so exhausted by people never being held accountable for their actions that we have now reached a breaking point where we, as compassionate, empathetic people, are just over it. And it's like, you know, you said you were sorry about this thing. You said you regretted this thing, but are you? And like, how many times have we done this? And like, you know, I'm sorry you were offended isn't really an apology. And like, blah, 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 but whatever you said before, but like, doesn't mean anything at all, right? I had that feeling as I looked at all of this, and I was just like, can I just leave this in the past and like be the person I am now? At which point, like Gazoo from, you know, Harvey Korman from the Flintstones popped up in the room next to me, and he was like, hello, dum-dum. And I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, you're growing. You're understanding that you're a different person than you used to be. And by examining the ways you have changed and grown, you're solidifying your emotional maturity, and you're able to lean in and embrace the person you are now by holding old you accountable while also being compassionate toward him. You're setting a good example. And I was like, wow, Kazoo, you've got like, I'm glad you showed up. I really appreciate it. And I went through the rest of the book with that attitude. And yet, when I did the audiobook, I still found places where I was like, oh, I missed the emotional beat here. I need to do it differently in my voice than I did in my words.
I think that's so, so interesting. And I think there's like a lot of what you just said can be said about like our emotional development as people and about how we grow as artists. Because mm-hmm. like, if you look back at yourself and there's things that don't make you go ick, like that means you haven't grown, right? And so like part of the growth process is looking back at yourself and being like, oh, that wasn't my best. But like that means that you are expanding and growing and learning. And that's like, that's where you want to be, right?
I spent my entire childhood under the thumb of two abusive narcissists who were very unsupportive of my humanity. And I grew up feeling that I was not allowed to make mistakes. And because I internalized that I wasn't allowed to make mistakes, I stopped taking risks. I missed out on so much in my life because I just was afraid of failure. And I have spent a lot of time thinking about this in particular in very recently. When we decide to learn a thing, I don't care what it is. My Tron machine is behind me, so I'm going to use that as an example. I want to get better at playing Tron, so I'm going to practice a lot. Turns out that I really suck at the beginning. That's okay. Sucking at something is always the first step. And the difference between the person who is having a good time 3 weeks from now. And the person who walks by the trauma machine and is like, fuck that thing, man, is the person who's like, I'm willing to push through this part when it's hard. Okay. Let's keep that framing in mind. Now let's think about what it means to be a person. We have to learn how to be a person. We have to learn how to have compassion for ourselves. We have to learn how to live with our mistakes. We have to practice kindness. We have to use the experiences we have had to inform our decisions in the future. Why do we put the same expectations on being a person that we put on getting good at the violin? We should not do that. It's the same pattern. It's the same approach. It's the same discipline. We just apply it to our lives and ourselves in the same way that we would apply it to any other skill. And a huge, huge part of learning something is messing up. A huge part of getting good at Jenga is letting those towers collapse on your table. If you look at that and go, I'm never pulling a single thing out because I'm afraid it's going to fall down. Well, guess what? Then you never get to play Jenga. The ways that I never got to play Jenga could fill volumes. And it is one of the only regrets in my life. I had to learn how to allow myself to make mistakes, to accept the mistakes that I made. And I really hope that if I can just serve as an example in this book to anybody who is open to the example, it's really okay to look back at something you did and be mortified by it and make amends where amends are appropriate, learn from it, and then the most important part of the entire process, celebrate how much you've grown.
You talk a lot about your relationship with your children. And I have to say, as a mom and a mom gamer who has taught her children, especially within the pandemic, my husband and I have brought my soon to be 7-year-old twins into the world of D&D.
That's great.
It was just one of my favorite things to read. Every time your relationship with your kids came up, and especially when you talk about being able to be friends with and hang out with your adult children, that is life goals right there.
It is. I believe that if parenting is easy, you're not doing it right. I believe that if it is easy, you're missing something and your kid is missing something. I don't know what that is, and I could be wrong. Maybe it is easy for some people, but it was real hard for me. I had to learn how to break generational trauma when I raised my kids. And it was my commitment to not inflict on my children the generational trauma my grandmother inflicted on my father, who then inflicted it on me. It was that commitment that really caused me and inspired me to work very hard to be an authoritative, not authoritarian parent, to be supportive while having expectations that were reasonable. And by putting down some guardrails and telling my kids, look, I know you're going to step over these guardrails from time to time. And that's cool. We all do it. I just don't want you to get hurt. At some point in your life, you're going to super fuck up. And you're going to be like, what do I do? Call your dad. I don't care what you did. I'm your dad. I love you. I'm here for you when whatever it is happens. I don't care what it is. And there was one night when my college age kid got wrecked at a party and was like, Dad, I need help. You know, and I was like, get in the cab and come home. I'll take care of you. You know, don't be ashamed. Don't be embarrassed. Don't hide it from me. You know, it would be better if you didn't do this. You know, that's better for you in general, but I get it. We all did that. All of us did it. You know, I felt like my parents just pretended that every single thing that every single person goes through emotionally as part of their development was either only happening to me, was wrong, was shameful, or was like brand new and existed only in my head. So I worked real hard to not pass any of that along to my children. And one of the things that I wanted to do was, I think modeling behavior to children is vastly more important than enforcing behavior with children. I wanted to model for my children, you can engage in competition without being competitive. You can enjoy the experience of playing a game, building a thing, learning a skill, making food without worrying about, do I win or not, right? If the only thing you care about is winning, well, you're going to be disappointed at least half the time and probably more. And I'm really grateful that my children received those values from me. I was just having a conversation with my boys last week, and they were talking to me about some things that they're doing, some ways they've chosen to spend their personal time, and some ways they've chosen to spend, like, you know, the tiny bit of money they have as millennials in this destroyed economy. And I listened to them talk to me about all of these things and became aware that, like, the values of kindness and empathy and social justice and tolerance and embrace of all people and a fundamental love for other human beings all exist in my kids. They're all there. Everything I wanted to give to them, they received from their mom and me. And it's just incredible. And I'm so grateful. And I wish there were more stories about them in this book. I didn't realize until I was done with it that I have written, I don't know, hundreds of pages of narrative stories exclusively about raising them, exclusively about things that we did together that I never published in a book. And I wish that more of those things were in there so more people could just get a little bit of a glimpse at these two remarkable men who just mean so much to me.
That's amazing, but now you have material for a third book. Just saying. I'm ready for it. But
just a geek raising a bunch of geeks.
I'm telling on myself a little bit. I did actually pull all of those stories together and I made a short run of 50 books and I gave them to the boys. I was like, I want you to have this. If you want to see the way that it was, I don't know if you remember what it was like when these stories happened, but if you want to remember these things and if you want to know what they meant to me when I was your young dad, well, this book is for you. And I kind of told him I wasn't going to publish it. I would have to get their permission because those stories at this point now kind of belong to them. But I hear you. I would love to share those stories.
Yeah, because that what you did is just that's so heartwarming and everything. And I'm very emotional right now hearing that because that's something I would love to do. Like my son's two now, so like. Anything could happen. Like what I ran up for.
You have plenty of time.
Yeah. So I was just like, that's something I want to have like a bond and be able to do that for my son. Yeah. But it's just listening to you talk about this and everything. And like the book's being marketed as like, you know, it's like a memoir of yours, but it's also kind of like a self-help book. Cause like I'm listening as a fellow parent, fellow gamer.
Yeah.
Of you talking on our interview and reading the book of just like, you know, this is really true. Like, I think a lot of people need this. And as you were talking to us, I'm like, are you the voice in my head? Like, this is, I guess the voice in my head is Will Wheaton. Like, okay. Like you, like it's, and I really like that it makes you more relate because yes, you're a normal person, but you're also a celebrity. And to be able to be like, no, like I could relate to someone like this of, you know, different age, different gender of something of someone who's so known and everything. It's just like, oh, that's really cool. Like I feel connected to more people. And I mean, you said before, Jen, of like growing as an artist, but like growing as a society, as a culture, I think this is important.
I think we are living in an age of extreme cruelty for the sake of being cruel. I think it's celebrated. I think it's encouraged. I think it's tolerated in ways it absolutely shouldn't be. And like, look, there is a reason. I think it was Gandhi when they were working to achieve their independence from Great Britain. I believe Gandhi said, be the change you wish to see in the world. And I had a teacher once who has just as a side assignment, was like, I want you guys to figure out what your purpose in life is. Like figure out that thing that's really important to you. And it needs to be something that can never actually be completed. There's something that's real important to you. He said, I don't know what it is, but there's something that's incredibly important to you. that motivates you all the time. And you probably don't know what it is. If you think about it, you can figure it out. And he said, it will take you years to find it, but look for it. Start today, start looking for it. And you will start out with a description that is a paragraph long, and eventually you're going to get it down to a couple of words. And it's taken me a very, very long time to figure out that what I do is every day I make a choice to do my very best to be the person I need in the world. And that I hope that by being the person I need, I'm not special. I'm not unique. The whole celebrity thing is kind of like a consequence of my job. It's not who I am. I just try to be that person, thinking that if I'm that person for me actively, I will passively be that person for someone else. And that can make a difference in another person's life. That is being the change I want to experience in the world. And I hope, you know, everything I write, everything has some component of, I really want you, reader, to be happy. And I want you to take something away from this, except when I'm writing political polemics about fascism. Like in that case, I want you to get angry. But like when I'm talking about kindness and mental health and addiction recovery and trauma recovery and all of those things, I think it's extremely, extremely important to live that by example so that there are people who will see, geez, this guy on the surface, this guy presents as having an amazing life, but like, that's weird. He kind of struggled with the same thing I did. We lived in very different worlds, but like I didn't grow up as an actor on TV, but I sure do see my dad in this book or whatever, you know, whatever it is. If you're that person, I'm sincerely really sorry. I just try to do more than, hey, everybody, look at me. Look at me. Check it out. Look at me. I'm doing a thing now. I'm the I didn't do it kid, you know. I have been given the privilege of a chair to stand on. And in addition to that, I've been given the privilege of occasional attention from the room. And I don't want to waste that. I want to do something good with it. I want to do something that when it is over, someone who was there thinks that was special. I'm glad that I was part of that, you know, because there's things where, you know, you go to great shows, you leave and like, that was a great show and you never think about it again. But sometimes you hear somebody say something and it just, you know, it gets in there. And I, when I have the privilege of those opportunities, I want to do the very, very best that I can to honor them and not waste them.
So I wanted to talk, first of all, that was amazing. I think we're all tearing up a little bit. So I wanted to talk a little bit about tabletop and how it came to be. You know, I know I've mentioned a few times and just briefly, and we did some like online tabletop in the beginning of the pandemic.
Some friends of mine, we did the same thing too.
For a while, you've been seeing tabletop and D&D and, you know, just different games starting to kind of come into the mainstream. And I think everything just kind of blew up during the pandemic because it really became a way for people to connect. But talk a little bit about tabletop and just how it all came to be.
So about 10 and a half years ago, my phone rang and it was my friend Felicia Day. And she said, I am going to go pitch a channel to YouTube. And they want a programming slate. Do you want to do a show together? Yes, I absolutely do. What do you have in mind? I thought, she said, you could like, I don't know, review games or something. And I said, okay. I feel like there's a YouTube show that exists that does a very good job of doing that. I kind of think the best way to review a game is actually to play it. And then this happened. Oh my God, Felicia, it's going to be you and me and a couple of our friends who are like kind of like internet famous, right? And we're going to get together and we're going to play a game and people are going to watch us play the game and they're going to see how fun it is to play a game while we're playing the game. And because we're going to have people who are like kind of YouTube famous on the show, people who don't play games are going to come to watch Hannah Hart and they're going to come to watch Brandon Routh and like they're going to like check it all out. And people who are gamers have a reason for their non-gaming partners to come in and see this show. And people who are non-gamers have a reason to come in and check out the show. And we're going to show people how incredible gaming is. That's what we're going to do. It all came together exactly like that. And I was standing in the front room of my house, looking out into the street. I can so clearly remember standing in the front room having that conversation. And she was like, I love that. Let's do that. And I said, maybe we could add a little element of like dinner for five to it, where maybe while we're playing the game, if there's a little bit of a lull in the action, then we can talk a little bit about that person's career and their work. And we tried that in some rehearsals and found that it felt very like shoehorned in and inorganic. And where the game came to life was when all four people were engaged at the same time. And I would always tell people, I told the editors and I would tell the players, there are two things happening in every episode of Tabletop. One thing is on the table in front of us, a game is being played, but above the table where our heads are, imagine a flat surface that connects all of our heads together. There's something going on there too. And whenever we have to choose between what's happening on the table and what's happening around our heads, we always go with what's happening around our heads, because this is about the joy of gaming. This is not reviewing games. This is not teaching games. This is none of that. This is celebrating the joy of games. Over its run, people did treat it as reviews. People did treat it as learning. I never intended for it to be that way. When I knew people were taking that out of it, we did our very best to meet that need, but it wasn't the driving impulse behind it. It was always share the joy of tabletop gaming with other people. And we succeeded. Boy, did we succeed. We changed the industry, and I am so proud of it, and I'm so happy for it, and I'm so grateful for it. And it is incredibly important to me that everyone within the sound of my voice knows this. Tabletop exists because of Felicia Day. Tabletop does not exist without her. Tabletop is good because it was developed by Jen Arnold, Sherry Bryant, Kim Evie, Felicia Day, and then me in the room. This was all women. This was all incredibly brilliant, creative, like super, super amazing women who were like, okay, I hear your like dude idea. This is why it's problematic. Oh shit, I didn't know that. And here's how we would do it. Thank you for that. Let's throw away what I thought was a good idea because I didn't know any better. And let's lean into these other things. Jen Arnold in particular is an award-winning, globally respected documentary filmmaker. She now directs American Horror Story and shows of that caliber. She is remarkable. That we got her for every season of Tabletop is a miracle. And people are constantly giving me credit for Tabletop, and I am not going to take it. I will receive it only in as much as I receive it on behalf of this incredible creative team that over the years expanded to include Adam Lawson and Ivan Van Norman and Steve Grubel and all of our editors. And it just became something so wonderful. I miss it all the time. Your follow-up question is, when are we doing it again? And the answer is, we're not. It's a tragedy. I'm sorry that Geek & Sundry was bought by people at Legendary who I believe ran it into the ground and destroyed everything that was beautiful about it. And I have no interest in being involved with them again. It's heartbreaking. But as we are on the 10th anniversary of Tabletop, it's very important to me to take a moment and say thank you to everyone who was part of that moment in my life. It was amazing. And as you can tell by looking behind me at my bookshelves, it is an enormous part of who I am as a person. And I've said it before, Tabletop is the cornerstone of and the mortar which holds together the foundation of the longest relationships in my life.
I love so much of what you just said. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the linkages between like the way that you create these cool things with your friends and actually the way that libraries operate, because like, I really think that like magical things happen when your goal isn't profit, but is engagement, but
100%.
Is fun and is expansion and, you know, and learning and all these things, you know? And I just think that's like such an exciting approach to creation, to creativity. Like, I just think it's such a, it just makes wonderful, wonderful things.
Our, you know, like we weren't looking to get rich. We needed to make a living, right? And I always ensured, it was extremely important to me that all of our crew got paid well, that their work was respected and appreciated, and that their compensation reflected that. I never took enormous paychecks. That wasn't what it was about at all. It was very much about all of those other things. And when Legendary came in, everything changed. It all became about how can we turn people upside down and shake every last quarter out of their pockets? How can we take Tabletop Day, which was supposed to be a global celebration of the hobby, and turn it into a shakedown to like extract money from people? It was disgusting and so deeply disappointing and heartbreaking to me. And I got to tell you, as someone who absolutely loves libraries, we talked about this before the podcast started, that you compared what we did to what you do just warms my heart so much, because I do know what you do. And I have done things at my local library. I walked into my local library one day and I was like, can I talk to the children's librarian? I have an idea. And the woman who was at the desk was like, I'm the children's librarian. What can I do for you? And I said, do you remember Choose Your Own Adventure books? And she's like, yeah, we check them out all the time. And I said, I do this thing on Twitch where I read Choose Your Own Adventure books and I let the audience decide what the choice is going to be. I would love to come do that live from your library. Do you think that would do well? And she was like, yeah. So they put me in a room that immediately filled up with people. So they put me in a bigger room that also filled up with people. And it was great. And I loved it. And it was so super, super special to me. And when it was all over, when it was all done, the librarian, who had just treated me like a person with an idea, was like, by the way, I love all of your work. And I was like, I really love that you waited until now for that, because I was feeling like a dad who loves a thing contributing to his community. That's what I wanted to do with this. That's all I cared about. I'm very fortunate to live a life where I'm not paycheck to paycheck, and I'm not worried about that. I used to be, and I'm not anymore. And it's important to me that I don't waste the privilege that comes with that, and doing things that benefit my community, I think is a way that I can give back something.
One of the things I definitely appreciate about what you just said was just, you know, just the whole like relationship between like when you spoke to the children's librarian and how gung-ho they were and just everything about it. It speaks very much to the changing nature of libraries. Too many people think of the libraries as, Stacey's going to laugh at this because I either usually say 1890 or like 1987, you know, like either you're like the librarian, I don't know, what was it in like, Are You Afraid of the Dark, where like she shushed you and put you in the quiet room, or, you know, like there's just so much misconception about the capability of libraries or just what libraries do, what we are. And I just appreciate so much that you were just like, yes, I know what libraries, what the capacity of libraries are, and I want to contribute to that. We're always, especially, I know Syosset, every library, you know, libraries with smaller budgets, libraries with bigger budgets, really what we're trying to do is we're trying to just kind of reach out to the community, and we're not driven by a profit margin. And a lot of it is a lot of experimentation. Like, is this going to work? Are people going to like this? And just, you know, that you say that, you know, you'd put your privilege behind trying to help that, amplify that is just, thank you so much.
Can I tell you a story about a librarian who was very consequential in my life? I was in third grade and we got to go to the library once a month as a field trip. And we went to the library and the librarian would read us something from a book. And then there was a table with books on it. and we were allowed to take a book. We could pick whichever one we wanted. So on this particular day, when your name is Will Wheaton, whether like alphabetically, you're screwed. They're just like first name, last name. Nope, you're screwed. Thank you, Henry Yan, for being in my class so that I didn't have to go last all the time. I'm sorry it was you, but I really appreciate you, Henry, for being there behind me, except for this particular day. They started at the end of the alphabet, and I was like, I'm going second. I really want that book with the magnet. Henry Yan jumped up and grabbed the book with the magnet, and I was just devastated. So the librarian comes over to me, and she says, what book would you like to pick? And I was like, the magnet book. And she says, I'm going to help you find a book. What do you like? And I was like, I don't know. What do you like to see in movies? I really like Star Wars. Okay, what do you like to watch on TV? I like to watch Star Trek and The Twilight Zone. And she says, do you know what science fiction is? And I said, I don't. And she said, science fiction is what you like. And I said, oh, okay. And she said, let's find you a science fiction book. And I was like, great, let's do it. She walks over to the table and she grabs a book called Z for Zachariah by Robert C. O'Brien. And it is a young adult novel with a female protagonist, which in 1980 would have been, most people would have discouraged me, a boy, from reading a book with a female protagonist. Right? Like, I loved Judy Blume and Beverly Cleary and was discouraged from reading their books because they weren't supposed to be for me. Right? And she said, I think you're really going to like this book. I wish I could remember. She described it a little bit. She kind of talked about the science fiction sort of aspects of it. And I took that book home and devoured it. It's the first time I kind of like sat on the floor and just read the book until it was over. And it fundamentally changed the course of my life because I now had a place to go. I now had an escape. I did not have to go home and deal with that environment. This was before personal computers. We didn't have the Atari yet, so I didn't even have that. I had no real outlet. I had no safe place. And now I did. And it turns out that it was books. And it was science fiction books. And that turned into a lifelong love of reading and exploring my imagination. And there is a short straight line between that woman in, I want to say, 1977, 1978, seeing this little boy and saying to him, I want to help you. I want to help you find the thing that is important to you. And the thing about this is, I know that you as librarians do this every day. You have this effect on people's lives every single day. Every librarian has this kind of effect on someone's life. And I just don't know if you know that. I don't know if you hear that. I don't know how often you hear from someone. I'm sure that this woman has long passed on. I wrote about her 15 or 18 years ago, and someone in the comments of my blog said, I know exactly who that is. Her name is, and I can't remember what it is. This person described the woman with the polyester pantsuit and the giant beehive hair and the glasses on the gold chain and the whole thing. And I was like, that's her! And this person who had grown up in the same area as I did, who was older than me, said she did that for me when I was in elementary school. That's who she was.
That's a really great story. And just to kind of put it in return, there are two people. One is a former coworker and one is a current coworker who we kind of gave a quick tip off that we would be chatting with you. And they both wanted you to know, Lisa and Janice wanted you to know that they had massive crushes on you as a kid when they were teenagers.
So I love that. Please tell them on behalf of teenage me, I say teenage me loves them back.
No, I'm glad that you said that, of like such an animated and emotional response about saying that librarians, because I luckily enough, like I've got to go see like authors at publishing houses, this is all like pre-COVID, of course, like, you know, always be like, oh yeah, yeah, no, yeah, we love libraries. Or like you might hear a politician be like, love the library, it's great, like photo op, which is great to hear that we could have like, you know, that impact on the community of like authors whose books like we have or we're interested in listening or purchasing in the future, or a politician knows we exist, because sometimes we're often forgotten, like arts or, you know, teachers, like there's other bigger things that come up on their dockets and whatnot. But it's so nice.
Those ridiculous bombs aren't going to buy themselves.
Yeah. But I just also want to say it's like promoting a genre that's often neglected. Yeah. Compared to just general fiction, like just seeing it. I mean, I love the library. I love SciAss. I love my home library. But often it's like the genre that's like, here's like fiction, here's mystery, like horror's gotten bigger, but like fantasy, sci-fi, like it's very like, oh, we need more space. Just get rid of some of those books. No one takes them out anyways. I was like, no, they do. They do. They're important. Like,
I was so excited when Lord of the Rings happened. When that trilogy happened, I talked to a lot of my fellow nerds, my fellow lit nerds, my fellow fantasy nerds, my fellow RPG nerds, and every single one of us had this moment. Did we win? I think we won. I feel like maybe we won. And guess what? Here comes the MCU to exist forever. Here comes Peacemaker. Here comes Suicide Squad. Here comes WandaVision. Here comes more science fiction and more fantasy and comic books as literature. We haven't even gotten into how much I love comic books and like how much that meant to me. Like, it's wonderful. It's terrific. And I told my kids from the time they were really little, I really want you to be readers, because you open yourself up to a world of knowledge and experience and perspective. When someone writes down something in a book, they are stopping a moment in time and telling you, you can open this and hop in a time machine anytime you want to and go experience it. And I told my kids, I don't care what it is, you read whatever you want, just read. Just read and like make that part of your life. And they both were and are readers. When Ryan was little, I would take him to the midnight book release for Harry Potter, and he would read, literally stay up all night reading it, and then muddle through the next day at school. And because I brought it up, it's really important to me that I take this moment to acknowledge that trans rights matter, and that it is extremely important to protect trans children. And J.K. Rowling, you have really let me down. You are one of the greatest disappointments of my entire life. But I absolutely love those books, and I love what they meant to my kids. It all goes back to that librarian who took an interest in me. Nobody else was interested in me. Teachers weren't interested in me. My parents certainly weren't interested in me. That librarian was interested in me. And I was just a kid. I was just a third grader in her library. And she treated me in a way that was so special and meaningful. I'm almost 50 and I remember it like it just happened.
Thank you so much, first of all, for all of that. I mean, really, just every bit of that. And, you know, I can only speak for myself, because I was children's librarian for about 15 years. You know, there really is, like, I was a reluctant reader for quite a while until I realized that I just like to read weird books. And you know, once I started reading, Stacey's laughing because she knows that's true, and so does Jen. Once, you know, like, you get the right book in the hands of the kid, that's it. My own kids, they're big gamers, as I mentioned, but they're obsessed with Kirby. And a few weeks ago, we went to a bookstore and we found a Kirby manga, and I was like, oh, you know what? We could get this. And like, they stay up at night reading it. And as a librarian and as a mom and as a geek, it's like perfect. I'm like, you've got the manga, you're reading, and it's a comic book.
Once my parents saw that I liked to read, I was allowed to stay awake as long as I wanted to, provided I was reading in bed. A tradition I passed along to my own kids. it is something I still try to do, although now I fall asleep about half a page in and I can't stay awake like I used to because I'm old. But they did give me that encouragement for all of the terrible things that they did to me. They did absolutely give me that level of encouragement. And I really enjoyed the incentive of like, I can stay in here and stay up as late as I want to, and nobody's going to come in here and bother me. And I get to go through the Mines of Moria again. Awesome. I'm all into it. Let's do it. That's great.
Relate to your son with the Harry Potter books, because while I didn't go to midnight book things because I didn't know they were a thing until like the Twilight books, and I went to the last one at Borders back in the day, but I remember getting the books when I was at sleepaway camp on like visiting day and being like, all right, I'm not doing any other activity but reading this book, like leave me alone, I don't care about kickball, get out of here. But I like that you promote that. And aside from what I was about to say, like, can you just be like the world's dad of like encouragement and everything? Just like a side note, just saying.
No, I really appreciate that. And I will tell you, and I sincerely appreciate that, because that is part of being the person I need in the world. I need a dad. I don't have a dad. I never got a dad. I got a bully. And I get to be a dad to my kids. And I don't know, there's just a thing, man. Like there's a thing, we can see it in each other. When you see another person who has experienced things, it's just there, you know? Like we hide it from people who haven't extremely well. But when we see a fellow traveler, it really shows up and it's really like very, very clearly there. And if I can be a loving, compassionate, nurturing father figure to people who don't have that or aren't getting it, that's a privilege. And that is something that I absolutely embrace. Anne and I joke about being your internet mom and dad all the time. And I actually have a couple of friends who I met when they were like 20. My friend Sam, she was, I think her parents brought her to a con when she was like 16 or 17. And I was like, you're a neat kid. What are you going to do with yourself? I think I'm going to be a photographer. Awesome. Look me up when you do stuff and like, let me know how it goes. And she would like send me pictures and, you know, like every now and then she was like, there's this boy. And I'd be like, listen, you got to talk to your mom and dad about it. Okay. You got to have that communication with them. But just remember, blah, 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 blah. You know? And I was like, and that we've stayed friends. She's in her mid 20s now. She photographs concerts. She's just, I'm so proud of everything that she is doing. And I do feel like in a way we were able to kind of support her in a way that she needed to be supported. And I've tried very hard to do that for other people as well. So to have that effort kind of acknowledged and called out, it makes me feel really good and seen. And I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Anytime.
And not to pile on too much, but you know, like something that really struck me about the book too is that like experiences of difficult childhoods and depression and anxiety can be so, so very isolating and make you feel alone and like there's nobody else who's going through what you're going through. And so just, you know, reading something like your book can absolutely change somebody's life and tell them that they can be a little less afraid and they can be a little less alone and they can maybe have a little bit of hope for like how things are going to turn out and how you're going to feel in the future. And that's an extraordinarily powerful thing. And I just want to thank you for that too.
I've had the incredible experience of talking to some people who have been affected by a thing that I did in one way or another that was meaningful to them. And it is, it's so special and I never take it for granted. And I'm so grateful for it. I encourage people to live their lives in a way that creates those opportunities because they're really great. They really feel that it just feels incredible. And when to the people who have been that person in my life, I will never be able to repay the kindness and patience and support that I got from them.
So before we wrap up, since you mentioned you're a Twilight Zone fan, what is your favorite Twilight Zone episode?
The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Oh, good one.
It is, you know, I can't tell you, I almost committed a massive NDA breach. I saw a thing recently that evoked a memory I had of the Twilight Zone. I had a memory. I saw something that evoked in me an emotion today that is similar to the Cold War emotions I experienced watching The Twilight Zone. One of the things I loved about that show, in addition to the twists and the allegory and all of those things that everyone loves that makes that a beloved show, The Twilight Zone demanded the audience pay attention. It demanded that the audience do a little bit of work and come along. And I really liked that. I have always loved things that take a little work. Because when I find somebody else who loves it in the same way, I know that that person has also done the work. And now we have an experience to share that goes beyond, oh, we're fans of this. It's like, oh, you like that? So do I. That's weird.
I am a huge Twilight Zone fan myself. Actually, so my favorite is one of the ones with William Shatner, but not the one with the gremlin on the wing. I like Nick of Time.
Great. I have one of those fortune telling machines.
So does my brother. Yeah, it's like, to me, it's so just this weird, relatable thing to anybody who's experienced anxiety or compulsions. And it just leaves you with that feeling of, was that all in his head or was it real? In a different way than the one with the gremlin on the wing did. And maybe that's because I relate to it a little bit myself, just those feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. The Twilight Zone, like all great science fiction, gives the appearance of being about one particular thing when it is in fact about something entirely different. Two people can be sitting in the same room watching two very different shows, and they're both watching The Twilight Zone, or Star Trek, or Deep Space Nine, or Firefly, or Battlestar Galactica. Like, that's just, that is, I learned that from science fiction really early on. The adventure of Star Wars was great. The space opera and the sword fighting was super cool. But the morality plays and the allegory and the challenge to be better inherent in the original Star Trek was deeply meaningful to me and influential in my life.
I have another question, because we're librarians. Yeah. Are you reading anything that you love now, or what's like a book that you like recommending to people that you've read?
I'm going to admit something really painful and not great. During the pandemic, I lost my ability to concentrate. I've lost my ability to fall into a book and stay there. I get real distracted all the time. I have to work through it. I have to push through in ways that I used to be able to pick up and put down like all the time. I'm like, oh, I'm in line at the grocery store. I'll read four pages. I have not been able to do that. I cannot tell you the thing that I just read that I loved the most, because it is an audiobook project that has not been announced and I'm NDA'd on it. But I did just read something that is, I think, going to be very special and really meaningful. The last two things that I read that I was like, no, I'm doing this no matter what, were Parable of the Sower and The Underground Railroad. I came to them through LeVar Burton's book club. And I read both of them and absolutely loved them. I really wanted to read The Handmaid's Tale. And it was too real. I couldn't do it. I couldn't watch the show. Same thing. It was just
me
all.
Me too. Me too. You know, years ago, I was in my early 20s. Actually, man, more than a few years ago. Anyway, moving on.
Keeps happening when you get to be my age, by the way. It's super great.
My friend was in a class, and this is before the TV series. There was almost like a Lifetime-esque movie with Robert Duvall from like the 80s. And she's like, oh, I have to, you know, this is before I'd known about the book. She's like, well, you know, I have to watch this movie and read this book. So we're watching the movie, and the movie itself was a bit cheesy. But then like about 20 minutes after talking about how cheesy the movie was, we're like, haha, this feels like it could actually happen. This is actually terrifying, which led me to read the book, which is even more terrifying. And then eventually, you know, I watched the show, the first season of the show, which was even more terrifying and well done. But so many people I know were started watching the second season, that opening scene, I was like, nah, done, can't do this.
I always gravitated toward dystopian fiction and post-apocalyptic fiction. I really enjoyed those sorts of things. I enjoyed the warnings inherent in them. I enjoyed thinking about like a post-nuclear world where our buildings are now in ruins. And like, I loved all of that stuff. And the fascism during the Trump presidency ruined all of that for me. Like, I was like, nope, I can't do this. I live in this now. I don't want to read about it. It's terrible. I don't enjoy it. A thing that I did just read that I'm over the moon about, that I can talk about, is John Scalzi's latest book, The Kaiju Preservation Society. It is delightful. It is unbelievably easy to read. It is my favorite thing of his that I've read since Red Shirts. It was a privilege and a pleasure to narrate it. And as John says, this is not a brooding symphony of a novel. This is a pop song. We are at a moment in time where what we need is 3 minutes of hooks that you can dance to, that you can put down and go on with your day. You need something that makes you feel good, that makes you shake your butt a little bit while you're making dinner. Like, that's what we need right now. That's what I needed when I wrote it. That's what I needed to read. That's what this book is. And he's absolutely right. And it delivers. It shows up. It gives you everything. The promise of the premise is It's so good. It is so good. Please, Hollywood, do not screw up the adaptation of this, because it is so good. So if you were like, I want to put like a Will Wheaton's recommendation somewhere right now, in April of 2022, that recommendation, at least until my book comes out, is John Scalzi's The Kaiju Preservation Society. And if you want to maximize your Wheaton-ness, I did narrate the audiobook, so that is available to you. Where I remind people, you can get audiobooks from your library, and it's great.
That book was fabulous. I'm so excited that you narrated it.
It was so much fun. I was texting John through the entire session. I think I spent 3 days reading it, and I just kept texting John, oh my God, this. Oh my God, this. This is brilliant. Is this based on who I think it is? Like, just all that fun stuff.
That's amazing. Oh no, I love that, because I'm a huge audiobook fan. And yeah. I have to say, you're a really wonderful narrator. Thank on your you. Books, because I've read all of Ernest Cline's that you've narrated. So I was just like, oh my God, he does it again. Yeah.
Oh, that's just very kind. So thank it's you.
Just to know that you also like audiobooks aside from narrating them. I'm just like, another win, because a lot of people
are massive audiobook not reading. Fan.
But no, I love it.
I don't really have like a commute anymore. I work mostly out of the house, and that's real fine by me. But I listen to audiobooks in the car, and when I walk the dog, I talk to her. I'm not like, you know, when I walk the dog, I talk to her and I work out story beats, you know, like I can't. What I've done, and I did this with Parable of the Sower, is I listened to it on audio because the narrator was brilliant. And I just kind of sat where I am now, very weirdly feeling like I wasn't doing anything, but I was while I listened to that book. So a challenge for me is, yes, Will, as it turns out, listening to an audiobook is an activity. It is not a passive sitting down. It's an activity you are engaged in that appears to be something it is not. I have to get used to that.
Thank you so much. This was amazing. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your praise of libraries. Thank you for just your open honesty about everything. And thank you for your book.
Yes, thank you.
You are so welcome.
Once again, this was Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast. My co-hosts were
Jen
and Stacy. I was like, are you not saying we're closing this chapter?
We get there at the end. We'll get there.
Whatever. We can edit things.
And our guest today was?
My name is Will Wheaton.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.
Oh, I was demonstrating, but I can start, so that's fine.
glasses on. That's not fair.
You can cap your amazing pink headset.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
All like, right. You don't need my I'm sorry. You don't need my permission. I'm just offering a suggestion.
I appreciate it.